Well, so Vittoria, what I liked a lot about this book in particular was the very lengthy introductory section that kind of sets the context for not just what is card space, but what are the sort of previous iterations of pieces of the puzzle that are also now included in card space, and what problems did those things solve, and what problems did they not solve, and why does that lead us to the architecture that we have now? One of the things that you mention is the option of SSL client certificates. And I find this very interesting because I can remember, I think it was about 1996 actually, when the capability was present then in both the Netscape browser and in IE, to actually be able to have a client certificate, be challenged by a website, present your client certificate, it can embed some attribute, right, which would transmit to the service. And I was thinking then, well, away we go, right? This is the way it's going to be. And no more passwords, right? And obviously that didn't happen. And there can be lots of speculation about why it didn't happen, but I'm curious to know, well, you should say, what your analysis is of what was, what were the reasons why we didn't get to something, a decade ago, which had at least superficially a lot in common with the InfoCart strategy that we see rolling out now.
Well, as I mentioned in the book, and thank you for your kind words, the SSL client strategy from the cryptographic perspective is perfectly sound. It's actually a very good system because it's already based on this idea of public key in asymmetric cryptography. So this is actually the paradigmatic example of how technology alone cannot solve a problem that implies human interaction. So the problem with the certificates are multifold. Basically, the main problem, which I believe slowed down distribution, is not specifically about interaction, but it's about distribution. With the fact that you cannot manage the machine of an end user, of a pure consumer, then it's very hard to get your certificate all the way, especially because the certificate is a construct that is made for computer scientists. If you think about it, a certificate is just something that says that the subject is the rightful owner of a certain public key, which doesn't really resonate with my mother, my sister, with anybody that is not computer savvy.
But it didn't have to be presented to people that way. It could have simply been presented to people as, here is, in modern terminology, we would say the managed card that you will use when you come back to this service and want to access it, right? This is your card that you use to come to, the Staples website, right? And you would have your Staples card, and you would have, there are other issues about the fact that, well, it would be, kind of a one-off thing, or how would you get to, ways of reusing cards in different contexts, right? But I mean, at that level, it seems on the face of it, it could have happened. It was maybe just too early in the history of things, maybe, and maybe also, and this is probably part of it, that the nature of those client certificates didn't lend itself to a richly expressive set of assertions, which could be embedded.
You are actually much closer to the point. So then the point here is that certificates cannot be managed cards basically for two reasons. One is practical and could have been easily changed. The experience of dealing with certificates, the store where you kept the certificates, were simply not friendly enough. That's to say that the metaphor that you mentioned could have been something to which you could have bent the certificate to belong. But there is another structural problem that is another thing that I believe we mention in the book. That is the difference between how to say primitive tokens, primary tokens, and issued tokens. And a certificate is a primary token. Is basically your credentials rather than your identity. That's to say that it is the mechanism that you use for proving that you are this, the person that has been entitled to that specific key. Mm-hmm. So it's not really you. Because if this certificate would have been given to me rather than to you, from the mechanic perspective, it would have been the same. That's to say that there is nothing in the certificate that says specifically that it's you. Mm-hmm. The certificate is your credentials. Your identity is instead something that is about yourself. So in the world of cards, when you use a managed card, you are actually leveraging a relationship that you have with somebody, where with somebody is typically the entity that issued to you the card. So your airline, your government, and similar. While the certificate could be the enabling mechanism for expressing this relationship. So, for example, if I am a customer of Alitalia, which is my glorified Italian airline, I actually go around with a card with my wallet that says that I'm a Frecciarossa, that's to say that is the highest level of miles that you can have. And thanks to this card, if I show it to the right people, also to the partners, I can actually enjoy a number of advantages that are part of my identity of a customer of that. However, this card can be used, if I have a certificate on it, for expressing the specific relationship. Because my identity, my relationship with this airline can change. The fact that I'm entitled to a certain right is something that changes on time and that is owned by the airline, not to me.
Okay. So I think this is really more to the point, right? Because the point about identity, well, your identity as a customer of the airline could be represented in the issuance of a certificate to you, right? And it what it says is yes, you are a customer of that airline, and the attribute in the certificate says that you're at this class of service, right? But it's hard coded in the certificate, right? So I think maybe what we're getting to is it's the more dynamic nature here of the, of the runtime resolution.
Exactly.
Of attributes.
So my point is the certificate is a very good mechanism in your hand for, protecting a transaction, like, for example, the transaction in which you actually reach back to your airline and you demonstrate that you are actually a customer. But then the attributes that make sense in the specific context, like if you can access or you cannot access a certain privilege, those are things that should come down dynamically. And yes, embedding those in the certificate is dangerous. And this is, in fact, one theme that I'm having with a lot of customers at the government level. I go around a lot and I speak with a lot of public institutions. And they tend to think in terms of transporting online what they already have offline. Like if you have a passport, it's basically like a cached token. Uh-huh. It's something that says, yes, you can travel, yes, you are Italian, and yes, you have this age. But in fact, reality is that online, it's really better to be able to give this information on the fly rather than caching those for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
One chief reason is that you can encrypt those directly to the intended relying party.
Mm-hmm.
So when they gave me my passport, they didn't know that I would have ended up later to go to Iceland or here in the States. They just gave me this blanket permission of traveling.
Yes.
While online, you can actually do things like every time I need to use my document for a certain reason, I can provide the content like, yes, I want my token because I want to go to the US. And then the token that says, yes, this person can go to the US can be encrypted directly for the US embassy, for example. Mm-hmm. Or for whoever is supposed to use this. While if I'd have this information cached, this information could not be encrypted for everybody, but necessarily they would have had to be accessible.
Yeah.
So since online, it's much easier to steal things because physically, if somebody wants to steal information from my passport, they need to have access to it. If instead I have just a generic, smart card, in which those attributes are in the clear, then this is much more dangerous.
Right. You also make an analysis in this chapter about Kerberos and how, in some ways, it has desirable properties, but you know, your conclusion is that the architecture doesn't scale for the internet. And I wonder if you can explain that analysis a little bit more.
So Kerberos in itself is, I believe, really the basis of many of interaction that we use. So this idea of having an entity that knows about you and can make assertion about you is actually there in Kerberos. The problem is mainly practical. That's to say that Kerberos is one specific technology, and as such, it's something that I cannot impose to everybody. It's a system. While if we want to talk with everybody, we need a meta system. That's to say that we need to abstract the capabilities that Kerberos have in a way that does not force every participant in the transaction to stick with Kerberos itself.
Uh-huh.
Also, Kerberos has a very authoritative view of the world. Kerberos is made for domains, that's to say in areas in which there is one entity that has complete control about everything and knows the keys of everybody.
Yes, an omniscient KDC.
Exactly. And
I think that was your point about the scalability, right? There's never, you know, in a heterogeneous world, there can't be an omniscient KDC. You need to federate that.
But that would be in the case in which, how to say, you would want an omnipresent Kerberos that covers the entire internet, which is something that in this moment I was not even considering. Let's say that on one side it would be very handy, on the other, the coral reef pattern of growing of the internet just does not allow for that. Now I was considering if everybody would be using Kerberos. So still Kerberos, but not one omnicomprehensive KDC, but many KDCs here and there.
Yeah.
Also, in that case, apart from the problem of getting everybody to buy the Kerberos model, the problem would be that in Kerberos, the KDC knows about the subject, but also knows about the relying party. The KDC has the keys of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
While in our world, that's not really the case. When we say user-centered federation, we actually mean that it's the user that, with its choices, is actually creating instantly a federation between the identity provider and the relying party. So if the relying party just says, I'm happy with tokens from identity provider A or identity provider B, if the user has both kind of cards, when the user chooses one or the other, is actually being the missing link that creates instantly a federation between those two entities. This is possible only if everybody has its own keys. So the relying party has its own identity expressed with its own public key.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes on and on.
And it's also possible if, I think only if the claims which can be expressed are represented as they are in the system as really URIs, right? Which are, you know, independent of any actor in the ecosystem, right? You know, so there's just a sort of set of claims out there, and if you know, an identity provider and a relying party agree to synchronize on the use of some claim, and someone can provide that claim conforming to that schema, then you can sort of dynamically bring together a transaction.
Absolutely,
right?
This is absolutely probably the main point. In fact, this point is so important that in the meta system, we even, how to say, take it into account the case in which we may not be able to pull that together. So in the meta system, we have this concept of claim transformers,
mm-hmm.
in which here and there you can perform application integration, in which if a relying party needs a specific claim that cannot be produced by a known identity provider, but the information, the equivalent information, can be extracted,
yeah.
Then we have mechanisms for bridging different claims. But the general idea is exactly what you said, that we should reach an agreement, at least for specific domains of knowledge, about common claims, so that we can describe things accordingly. So that's actually pretty close to these ideas of a semantic web. It's simply that, in my opinion, claims makes it more actionable because the semantic web tries to do everything, invest of significance everything. While with claims, we are in a very specific area. So our chance of succeeding as an industry is much higher.
Domain specific.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So in the sort of the mainstream world of blogs and the popular press right now, you know, you tend to hear the terms OpenID and Cardspace almost interchangeably at this point. And there's a sense in which that's not inappropriate, right? I mean, there's a sort of a single sign-on aspect where the two overlap and, in fact, complement one another. It would be helpful to try to spell out, the deeper differences, you know, and this idea of, sets of claims and the possibility of claims transformation in particular is, I think, one of the things that distinguishes the meta system from what's happening, at least so far, in OpenID, as far as I understand it, right? You know, so I think that the use cases for OpenID are largely around single sign-on, and I believe now with 2.0 there's a move toward attribute exchange, right? So, you know, so that's also a piece of it, you know. But try to sketch out what the domain of the meta system is, you know, beyond what it is that OpenID can provide or will be likely to provide in the near future.
Sure. So I have to say up front that I'm not an expert in OpenID, so I hope that any naiveties of mine will be forgiven. So for what I know about OpenID, everything in OpenID happens within the boundaries of a browser. That's to say that every interaction is, in the end, a browser redirect. So I find it extremely useful because OpenID is actually closer to this idea of omnidirectional identifier, which is something that sooner or later we have to deal with. While cards are specifically metaphors that help me to do things that are monodirectionals. That's to say that every time I use a card, I use it for establishing a transaction that is specifically with one relying party. Mm-hmm. The same happens with OpenID, but the perception of a user is that now you have an URI that describes you. So somehow that, in my opinion, opens up to future developments. And we are in desperate need of those, because all the things that you see about Facebook and similar, those are just the signals, in my opinion, that the industry needs to do the same for omnidirectional identifiers than what we have done, what we are doing, executing for more unidirectional identifiers.
So define these terms a little bit.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm using a context. So the idea is that your identity or identity in general can have different audiences. There is the omnidirectional audience, let's say something that you use for being recognized by everybody. So if you land on the VeriSign website and you go on HTTPS, their certificate is basically what spells out their public identity.
For everyone.
It tells to everybody that website is VeriSign. Then you have unidirectional identities. So if I am landing on a website and this website, for making business with me, is asking to know my age, then I can actually use a ceremony with Windows Cardspace so that I can obtain a token specifically for that website, which contains the information that this website is asking for me. We call this token the unidirectional identity. That's to say that my flow of identity is going straight to that relying party and nobody else. And in fact, we take steps for keeping that so. So, for example, the identifier is only for that website, the encryption is only for that website, and so on.
And this actually will map to the attribute exchange that's emerging in OpenID, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Exactly. They are very close. The point of this is, when you use a card, or even OpenID today, what you are doing is actually engaging in a unidirectional contest. Let's say that you are obtaining and transmitting your attributes, your identity, to one specific relying party. Now, what I was mentioning before, and it was actually going away from answering the question, and I will get back to that, is that the OpenID in the perception of a user is something, how to say, that identifies you in a unique way. Let's say that I have my my OpenID account, that is vibroopenid.com, and it's a sort of my URI. Let's say it's my identifier. So since it's an identifier that is directly omnidirectional, so it's something that everybody knows, it's not something that I have to keep secret. While in my cards, there is nothing that I tell to everybody. My card is always designed to be one directional. Mm-hmm. So I believe that it's a good starting point for beginning to think about an ecology of an omnidirectional identity. That's to say, how do I handle identity in a situation in which I want to project it everywhere, not just for that specific relying party? Mm-hmm. So, for example, you heard about this Facebook beacon. So that's one example of, in my opinion, is a symptom of a fact that we need to think about omnidirectional identity. Also, all these concepts of identity provider that we have both for OpenID and for CardSpace, they are both, again, for giving you attributes to yourself. Let's say that I go on a website, I want to buy wine, I am the one who is asking the identity provider to certify my identity. While in the world of social networks, for example, the requester of an identity may be somebody other than me. If somebody is looking at my profile, it's not me, but it's still asking about identity information about myself. So this is an area that, in my opinion, needs to be fought a bit. And we did, as an industry, an excellent job in going after the unidirectional. And in fact, now we are executing. The ecosystem, both for OpenID and CardSpace, is very vital. We are really executing. We came through this thinking phase that is not over, especially in the interaction parts, the parts that you were saying, how OpenID collaborates with CardSpace for obtaining. And I promise that we will get there. I'm sorry for rambling after that. But it's really an area in which, in my opinion, we need to start thinking. Because the moment in which we find the laws, exactly like Kim and the industry did for the unidirectional interactions, things like Beacon will probably not happen. Let's say that, and I'm not making any judgment. Let's say that I could have made that decision myself. Let's say that it's simply that I believe we need to start to extend the conversation also to omnidirectional identifiers for end users. Because the example that we made before was a website. VeriSign has its own public corporate identity. While in this moment, our public identity is an emergent phenomenon. If you Google yourself, if you live.com yourself, you will find your traces on the web, traces of your identity, or maybe the identity of somebody that has your same name. If you go on...
Or someone that said something about you.
Exactly. So
made a claim about you.
Exactly. So all these as an, how to say, a laws, physics laws, I believe, that in this moment we didn't try to spell out or to discover. Some time ago in Gartner's blog, you know that the analysts of Gartner from time to time, they write on their blog their own ideas. And you know, it's very interesting. And one of these guys, I can't remember his name, unfortunately, was saying that he believes that in the future we are going to have to certify also things like images or content. Since our capability of making digital things to look like reality is so greatly enhanced. Just yesterday, I went to see Beowulf at the IMAX in 3D. It was just amazing. So there will be a moment in which we will need to certify the authenticity, not just of people or entities, but also things, content.
Yes. Yes.
So I believe that this ecology of the identity it needs to grow up to a point of encompassing also these things.
No, I've been making this exact point recently, and it's in the context of you know, me seeing a way forward for the blogosphere that moves in the direction really of at the high end what we have now in scholarly and professional publishing, right? Where the artifacts that people produce, you know, the papers that they publish, you know, they have digital object identifiers, right, which are being managed, you know, over the long haul so that the citations can be reliably done and so that, you know, claims can be made. You know, this is not just the paper that was published by me. This is the paper that was published by me and was peer-reviewed by these people. And you start to build up a fabric of claims around, you know, where the subject is the digital object, not necessarily the person, right? So, but where you were going with omnidirectional identity? In other words, that in that sense, I'm, you know, I'm asserting an omnidirectional kind of claim about this artifact that I've produced, and it's really broadcast, you know, for the world. Is that the idea?
Yeah, and basically the idea was that with OpenID, you start having at least the base for all the discussion that we're having. Let's say that you have an omnidirectional identifier, or at least a handle, something that you can use for then gaining these omnidirectional identifier.
Okay.
So while we can do it also with the cards, but we don't push it as a metaphor. Also, OpenID is not pushing it as a metaphor. It's just a side effect that they have. But I believe that it will be useful. So it was a sort of a digression for which I apologize. And now I can get back to your main question, that was how OpenID and CardSpace relates and how they can work together. So OpenID is very, very handy because it's something that lives in the cloud, and it's very easy to access because, as I mentioned, everything is done via redirections.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have intrinsically the concept of passwords embedded, which is fantastic.
Because, as we've just seen, you showed me how I went and did it. I have a completely passwordless OpenID account at myopenid.com now, which is wonderful.
And it's beautiful. It's really beautiful because if I'd have both passwords and cards, there would still be a venue for getting there.
Sure, there's a weak link. Yeah.
Exactly. If somebody calls me and says, can you please give me your username and password, and I give it, well, then it's, how to say, having the cards didn't really help me much. While with cards, we eliminated one of the key weaknesses, not of OpenID in itself, but of any browser-based interactions. That said, in my opinion, the fact that you never leave the browser is a limiting factor. For a number of situations, that's perfectly okay. If I'm logging in for a blog, for example, then I really see no issue. It's a perfectly valid way of interacting. But you have to take into account that the end user is not really very good at seeing clues, like understanding, just looking at the browser, if they are in the right page. So what may happen is that since when you look at one web page, not just the appearance, but the law of physics of that page are decided by what you are rendering, you may actually get redirected in the wrong place. So we can put a lot of safety mechanisms here and there, but in the end, if the website is the complete master of what goes on in that universe, then you are going sometime to have some attack venues that you cannot avoid.
Sure. So this is one of the principles of consistent user experience, which is one of the seven laws, and point taken that it is difficult, well, I suppose probably impossible, to enforce a consistent user experience, you know, without something that is a branded consistent chunk of UI, right?
But even if you would do it, that may not cover you completely. Let's say that even if everybody would decide, every OpenID provider would decide that the UI for authenticating is exactly the same, then with the fact that you never leave the browser, every interaction happens within the boundaries of HTML and JavaScript, then this means that whoever is starting the experience could pretty much make you, how to say,
it's
make you believe whatever they want, because they have complete control of your only window on reality.
Yeah.
While when you use an identity selector, so not necessarily card space, anything else, you are actually, how to say, diving out from the normal connection. Let's say that whatever you obtain in terms of identity actually happens outside the browser itself. So the browser may actually ask for the selector for a certain token. But then in the end, how you obtain this token is handled outside the browser, which may actually give you a number of extra guarantees. Furthermore, when you use a selector, you actually have a chance of using what we call the active profile. So now it's improper because they recently changed the specification and they lose this idea of passive on active profile. Anyway, the main difference is that an identity selector is able to secure things at the message level. And also, the token that you obtain can contain claims, but can also contain keys. Keys that you can actually use for securing messages. So, in the case of a selector, you actually are able to use WS security and use the holder of key rather than token bearer, which gives you extra guarantees.
So and let's actually jump in here, because this is, of course, one of the key distinctions. And the, you know, the fact is that the protocols for OpenID are very light and simple, and that's attractive to people, right? It's easy to get things done. It's quick. It's not, you know, it's not stacks and stacks of WS star specifications. And, you know, that's clearly an important thing, right? And it's clearly a reason why it's gaining traction, because people can figure out how to do it and quickly get it done, right? And so, you know, there's the identity selector piece is sort of separate from the level of protocol complexity, you know, which is behind the glass, right? Sure. And we can kind of talk about those things separately, right? You know, so one could imagine, you know, the very lightweight protocols of OpenID, you know, grafted onto identity or selector technology. Well, we have that now, right? I can use CardSpace, you know, simply as a front end to OpenID, right? You know, but the protocols that are being spoken are still very simple. On the other hand, you know, I mean, your chapter in the book about, you know, WS Trust, WS Metadata Exchange, WS Federation, it's the kind of thing that makes people want to kind of go and take a nap, you know, and you know, lie down until the
yeah,
right? So what about that, right? I mean, how do you delineate what is the what is the nature of the value that comes from those heavier weight protocols, right? And how do you compensate for the difficulty of making effective use of them, right? Where's the sweet spot there?
So actually, I would literally start from your last sentence, that is difficulty of making use of them. On that, I have actually to disagree. Let's say that the usage of those is as straightforward as it can be. If you think about it, every single time you use a card, behind the scenes, you have all the standard negotiation that happens with WS Trust, WS Exchange, WS Security. And yet you are blissfully ignorant of what goes on.
So
from the usage perspective,
sure. Okay. Yeah.
Is absolutely clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you think of Kerberos complexity, or if you think even of a TCP IP itself with its back-off algorithm when it has to retransmit packets, or with a new long-run enhancement in which it decides for you the size of a TCP frame depending on your bandwidth. Those are all things that are pretty damn complex. And the point is that you don't care.
Right.
Because they sink inside of a platform. The idea is that today you are aware of those because it's an historical moment, because it's happening right now. But in this moment, they are sinking into the platform. I'm sure that you have been in the computing area for a long time. So I'm sure you can remember a moment in which you were supposed to install the TCP. While you were installing the operating system, you actually had to choose the TCP because it was something that was, how to say, happening there. Or even before that, you'd have to write applications thinking of a specific monitor that those applications were going to use.
Mm-hmm.
So WS Trust may be complex. In my opinion, not so, but yet my license plate is WS Star. So I'm not the right
person. So you're
disqualified. Exactly.
Is it really?
Absolutely,
your license
yes.
plate is WS Star?
Yes. The first thing I did once I moved to the States, since here you have a vanity plate. So I'm not the right person.
No, clearly not.
But okay. In general, the idea is that those protocols are more complex because they are trying to address in a broader set of scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there is no assumption of HTTP whatsoever. All this stuff happens at the message level. So, I can pretty much have these to work on any present or future transport protocol, which is important.
Yeah, although in practice...
In practice, today, the HTTP, and in fact, we are optimized for HTTP, and we work pretty well. And in fact, we are not forced to use the active profile. When you use Windows Card Space for authenticating with a website, you use the active profile, or you can choose to use the active profile when you obtain the token from the identity provider. But from the moment in which the token is in the hands, of the browser, you can actually use it exactly like any other cookie. You have to say that you don't use the key, you just send it in a secure pipe or also in a non-secure pipe if you decide to do so.
So here's the, to boil it down to me, and this is the argument that I always wind up making, because I'm a complete agnostic, right? And I'm happy to use REST where REST makes sense, and I'm happy to see that there are scenarios where, you know, the WS Star protocols also make sense. And in the latter case, to me, it sort of always comes down to those cases where you have some sort of declarative, you know, policy-driven scenario. And it's not just, you know, it's not just a conversation between a couple of endpoints, right? You know, but there's, you know, there's a set of transactions that are embedded in a policy fabric. And, you know, by being able to flow through intermediaries, which can make claims transformations, which can assert policies, you know, which can require... you know, that certain kinds of credentials are presented in certain kinds of contexts and can audit and monitor and, you know, and do all those, you know, enterprise-y kinds of things, right? You know, that's class of scenario for which, you know, this more advanced and sophisticated functionality is designed. And I think the problem that we get into is that we have, you know, we have this sort of myopia that says, well, look, and all that stuff that's just happening on the web, and the web works, therefore, right, this is the you know, the right only best way to do it, right? And, you know, on the other hand, you know, if you talk to people who are in the area of, let's say, the secure exchange of, you know, medical information or prescriptions or, you know, personal health records, you know, and there are, you know, multiple stakeholders involved in asserting claims and policies about how that information is going to flow, then in fact you do, you know, get to this place where you need stuff which is just, it's just harder, right? It's there's no getting around it, right? It is irreducibly harder, you know, to meet all those requirements, you know, and there's no pretending that it's easy. It's just more complicated. It's just harder, you know. So then, you know, then it just becomes a question of, all right, well, where are you going to get the support that enables you to do those things? And, you know, Microsoft is putting together a very strong story around framework, around tools, around WCF, right? So if you want to live, you know, in that ecosystem, right, and you have the luxury of doing things in a homogeneous way, right, you know, then that's fine, right? You know, but then there's the issue of, well, in fact, it's never homogenous, right? And so, you know, now, you know, that sort of gets to the whole issue of, you know, of interop, right? Which is hard, right?
Yeah.
It's not solved, right? Is just, you know, there's no, you can't sweep that under the rug, you know, I don't think. And I don't think anyone, I could be wrong, but I don't think anyone is making the claim that OpenID is intending to occupy that ground.
All the scenarios that you mentioned, the enterprise ones, are actually the briefing ground of WSDR. The point is that now we want to be able to do more complex things directly from the web. So things like accessing your bank account or using your financial information for buying stuff or getting a mortgage or expressing your citizenships or accessing your medical records.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all things that require enterprise-level guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
So those are areas in which WSDR can help. So I cannot make the names, of course, but part of my day job is literally flying around the world and talking with governments or big players that are interested in this new generation of technologies. And I can tell you that they are very protective of their data, and they need to provide very strong guarantees to their citizens, to their patients, to their customers. So OpenID is an extremely specialized animal. It's great, specifically for the web. It's really, how to say, the sun of our times.
Mm-hmm.
People are bored of remembering many different credentials, and who can blame them? And OpenID is a great way of overcoming those. Then, there are scenarios in which you need to be able to model existing business relationships. So WSDR, WS Policy, WS Metadata Exchange, their power is that you are able to describe a situation that already exists, so that you can leverage online what you are already have in place in the offline world.
Mm-hmm.
So if I am a citizen and I manage to express these with a managed card, then I'm able to use my privileges online automatically. I don't need to have a relying party that somehow renegotiate everything online. So if I am a customer of a bank, it would be beautiful to be able to express this fact directly without having to go somewhere and reestablish a different password and, how to say, again, building that bind that I already have in, how to say, real life.
Mm.
And using WSDR is something that allow you to express those things. And since it's a meta protocol, because you can use whatever technology for actually making the encryption, and you can use you can express those things using WS policy. So you can negotiate on the fly which technology you want to use via WS metadata exchange. In the end, you have your decoupling layer that allow you to describe your business situation without committing to a specific technology. And here we come to the interop. Interop is one of the most heartfelt topics in this area. And in fact, there is a constant effort for keeping this stuff real. If you check Mike Jones' weblog, which is self-issued info, he talks a lot about the OSIS effort. He is directly involved in this effort of organizing, every time there is an identity-related conference, these parties in which everybody brings its own technology, and they actually build the Cartesian product.
Mm-hmm.
Of everything talking to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And they publish their results in a wiki to an address that now escapes me. And I can tell you it's impressive, because that table that started pretty much completely red is now walking toward the green at a steady pace. And every time they make a new event, new players come to the table.
So the part that's easily visible to people now is the Cardspace to OpenID You know, anyone pretty much can go and find out what that's like, set it up, and use it. The part that's not visible to people is what you see, though, when you travel around and you visit these governments and these businesses and are working through these more advanced scenarios. At what point do you think that these case studies can become more visible to people so we can see and discuss and understand what's going on there? Because until we really can, it all feels kind of abstract and remote. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So it's really hard to answer because in the last 2 years, we engaged literally with every big name you can think of. I don't think that we didn't cover anyone. And everybody is extremely interested because they can see the disruptive potential of this technology. What I can tell you is, and I know that it's a matter of faith, so you can choose to believe me or not, that there's really a lot of people that are very serious about Windows card space, that are building prototypes, they are building proof of concepts, they are building pilots. And those things are internally already up and running, and they are experiencing with that. So I'm pretty sure that fairly soon you will see something coming down the pipe.
Okay. Well, fair enough, Vittorio. And well, we haven't really said much about the book specifically, but congratulations for doing that. I've written one of those. I know the incredible level of effort and commitment that it takes to do it. And I just want to say that it lives up to its title. I mean, the title is Understanding Card Space, right? And after I read it, I had a better understanding of card space. And so it does the job. Nicely done on that.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. This praise really means a lot to me. Thanks a lot.
Okay. All right.